going to talk about deep brains a little bit more. Well, it has been discussed by Katrin last week a little bit about deep brains. But I realized that if I start talking about deep brains, it's going to take me a couple of lectures just to cover deep brains appropriately. So I decided to not go more into deep brains. Maybe tomorrow I'm going to discuss a little bit about deep brain charges, because it's the subject of the tutorial of today. So if there is time tomorrow, I'll discuss about deep brain charges. So what I would like to discuss today is about Calabi-Yaufman magnifications. And the discussion about Calabi-Yaufman magnifications is going to be necessarily sketchy if you try to discuss Calabi-Yaufman manifolds in 1 hour, though I think there are going to be probably some important points that are going to be useful for the study. So let me tell you some highlights about Calabi-Yaufman manifolds. So the goal of today's lecture is to understand how can we have so far been discussing 10 and 11 dimensional theories. So, but we know that we live in four dimensions. So the question is, how can we describe our four dimensional world? And there are two approaches in the more modern literature. One that is Kaluza-Klein compactification. Which is the straightforward generalization, well, the straight generalization of what we discussed when we saw how 11-dimensional supergravity by compactification on a circle gives us type 2A theory. So the Kaluza-Klein ansatz is something similar, and I'm going to discuss this in detail in today's lecture. Then there is a second approach, which is the brain world scenario, which I will not discuss today. But let me just mention what the basic idea of brain world scenarios is. And so the basic idea of brain world scenarios is that our world is a four-dimensional D-brain, so 4D world, and we live on a D-brain. And that gauge fields, so the gauge fields of the standard model, live on the D-brain while the gravitational force propagates in the bulk. So force propagates in the entire, so there is no compact manifold. So in this Kaluza-Klein approach, what we will see, let me step back for a second, what we will see is that the 10-dimensional space-time is the product of a six-dimensional internal manifold times a four-dimensional manifold, which is our space-time. This four-dimensional manifold is infinitely extended, while this M6 here, the internal manifold, is very small of Planck size. So in the brain world scenario, the picture is a little bit different. We do have our M4, which is infinitely extended, but there is no small compact manifold M6, but there is the entire 10-dimensional space-time in which the gravitational force propagates. And the point of this scenario is that it's the metric, so it's called a warp matrix, so there's a warp factor in the metric that influences, so that has consequences on the physics that lives on the brain, and which explains, for example, why gravity is such a weak force. And let me throw at you just the word gravity is weak. So let me just for now leave it at the word warp factor, and I probably will discuss more about warp factors tomorrow when I get into flux compactifications, because such warped metrics and warp factors will play an important role there. So as I said, so my goal is to generalize so what we know about circle compactifications to the case of a 10-dimensional space-time, which is the direct product of M6 times M4. And even though the internal manifold, the six-dimensional internal manifold, is very, very small of Planck size, the properties of this internal manifold will be telling us about properties of the four-dimensional low-energy effective action. In other words, taking different internal manifolds will give us different four-dimensional effective theories. So the question is, can we find a manifold M6 that produces a four-dimensional theory that is on our wish list. So what do we wish for in four dimensions? So M6 determines the four-dimensional effective action, so determines for the action. So what do we wish for? So let's make a wish list and then hope that we can find a six-dimensional internal manifold that guarantees that we get whatever we would like to have on our wish list. So what do we want to have? So we would like to have maybe SU3 times SU2 times U1 gauge group. So that would be good, gauge group of the standard model. And what else do we want to have? Maybe we want to have an n equal to 1 supersymmetry. So we discussed about supersymmetry yesterday a little bit. N equal to 1 supersymmetry. And I had mentioned yesterday one reason that we would like to have an n equal to 1 supersymmetry is that n equal to 1 supersymmetry allows us to explain the hierarchy problem. So the reason here is number one, it allows us to explain the hierarchy problem. Namely, why is the Higgs mass so much, the mass of the Higgs hierarchy problem so much lower, the mass of the Higgs so much lower than the Planck mass? And number two, n equal to 1 supersymmetry is an important ingredient when we would like to discuss grand unified theories. So you may have heard that the idea of grand unified theories is that the gauge groups that of the standard model that we see or the coupling constant at a certain energy unify, and this gauge group becomes one single gauge group, maybe SU5 or SO10. And it turns out that only in supersymmetric grand unified theories can you find such a unification of couplings. So unification of couplings, while in the non-supersymmetric case, the couplings miss each other. So what else? So there's a technical reason, a practical reason why we would like to have supersymmetry. And I had mentioned it yesterday, and today we are going to see this in detail. Namely, solving supersymmetry equations is easier than solving the equations of motion. So while equations of motion are second-order in derivatives, so take Laplace of phi is equal to 0, it's an equation that is second-order in derivatives. An equation following from a supersymmetry constraint is an equation that is first order in derivatives, which means it's going to be easier to solve. And the statement is that every solution to the supersymmetry constraints, and we are going to see what I mean concretely with solution to supersymmetry constraints a little later. So every supersymmetric solution or solution to the supersymmetry constraints So every supersymmetric solution solves the equations of motion. But not in the other way around, so not every solution to the equations of motion is supersymmetric. So, and let me show you in a simple, so why such a statement is so. Let me show you in a very simple example coming from Bessenbagger how for global supersymmetry, how you can see that every solution to supersymmetry constraints is a solution to equations of motion. So let's take the simple case of global supersymmetry, where we know that we do have a Hamiltonian that is expressed in terms of the supercharge as Q dagger times Q, where Q is the supercharge. And what we know is that supersymmetry acts on bosons, so transforms bosons into fermions. When it acts on a fermion, it gives us a boson. A supersymmetric state, so a state that is supersymmetric is annihilated by the supercharge. So let me call the state psi equal to 0. This is a supersymmetric state. So what I see from the form of the Hamiltonian, Q dagger times Q, is I see two things, or a number of things. We see, first of all, that the energies of such a Hamiltonian, it's a Hamiltonian that is Hermitian. So the energies of this Hamiltonian are, number one, real and bigger than zero, because the Hamiltonian is a square. So I see from here that energies are bigger than zero from the form of the Hamiltonian. So what else do I see? I see that H commutes with Q from the form of H. So H and Q commute. So from there, we can deduce already that a state that satisfies the constraint that Q acting on psi is equal to zero is a solution to the equations of motion, because the equation of motion is simply, so I have a state that satisfies Q psi is equal to zero. If I hit this equation with Q dagger, so Q dagger times Q acting on psi is equal to zero, which is nothing but H acting on psi equal to zero, which is the equation of motion of the theory, because this is then the state that minimizes, so it minimizes the energy. Psi is a state that minimizes the energy, because I said the lower bound of the energy is equal to zero. So this is the equation of motion of the theory. And what I see is that every state that satisfies Q times psi equal to zero has to be a solution to the equation of motion, but not in the other way around. OK, so that's a practical reason why we would like to have supersymmetry. And we are going to see later on a direct application when we look at the supersymmetry transformations of a hederetic string. And we are going to see what it means to solve the equations. There are a number of other reasons why we would like to have a supersymmetric theory in four dimensions. Namely, we can make extrapolations from weak to strong coupling. I had mentioned it already some time ago when we were discussing weak and strong dualities. So sometimes there are quantities that can be computed at weak coupling. And if you know that the quantities that you computed are supersymmetric, there's going to be enough constraints on that quantity so that you can follow it to strong coupling. So an example of this is the entropy that Strominger and Wafa calculated. So let me first write down here extrapolation. From weak to strong coupling. So an example of this, as I was saying, is the entropy that Strominger and Wafa calculated. So they calculated, so they made accounting of microstates for the regime where the black hole was a deep brain. So in that case, you can simply using methods of conformal field theory count the number of microstates. And then you can follow those, you can argue those states that give you the entropy, the number of states is going to be the same if you go from the deep brain regime, which is the weak coupling regime, to the strong coupling regime of the black hole. So that's one example. And the last reason so is that n equal to 1 supersymmetry. And why precisely do we want to have n equal to 1 and not n equal to whatever else? So let me put, why not n equal to bigger than 2? So because n equal to 1 supersymmetry is precisely as restrictive as we would like to have it. So while other supersymmetries, say like n equal to 2 supersymmetry, is going to put us so many constraints on our theory that at the end it's not going to be a theory that is phenomenologically so interesting. Okay. So, and what we are going to see is that the conditions, so when we look now for solutions to supersymmetry constraints, we're going to enter, so we're going to discover the territory of algebraic geometry. In a very beautiful manner, so it emerges more or less by itself. So let me tell you what, let me tell you some simple remarks about Calabi-Yau manifolds and show you how they emerge in superstring compactifications. So let me throw at you first the definition of a Calabi-Yau manifold, and then I need to give you some basics, which we are going to need later on. So Calabi-Yau manifolds. Or let me give you the general definition of a Calabi-Yau n-fold. So Calabi-Yau three-folds are the six-dimensional ones. So n, this n stands for the number of complex dimensions. So Calabi-Yau three-folds are six-dimensional. So three-folds are six-dimensional manifolds. So let me put it in this way. So Calabi-Yau three is the M6 we were discussing. While the other cases, so if you take a four-fold, you're describing an eight-dimensional manifold and so on. So in general, a Calabi-Yau n-fold is a complex. So it's a complex Keller manifold with SUN holonomy. Well, maybe the complex I could have dropped here because Keller manifolds are complex. So it's a Keller manifold with SUN holonomy. And I probably need to explain to you what holonomy is. Before I do that, let me give you an equivalent definition of Calabi-Yau manifolds, which is the one we are going to be using later on, which tells us that Keller manifolds, that it's a Keller manifold that is Ricci flat. So Calabi-Yau manifolds are Keller manifolds that are Ricci flat. In other words, that the Ricci tensor vanishes for those manifolds. So this is a statement. So the statement that I made about the equivalence between these two definitions of a Calabi-Yau manifold, yeah, give me just a second. The statement that I made about the equivalence of these two definitions of the Calabi-Yau manifolds is due to the Calabi conjecture. So it's due to the, so that was the Calabi conjecture. And that was proven by the famous proof that Yau gave in 1957. So that's a complicated mathematical check how you can see that both definitions are equivalent. But this is the one that at the end will emerge from the string theory compactification. Yes? A Keller manifold. I'm going to define every word I do have there. I'm going to define it for you. So. Just give me a second. Let me first start with, I defined for you holonomy, defining what holonomy is, because I need to give you a little bit of background how we can define spinors on curved manifolds, because that's going to be crucial when I later on try to evaluate the supersymmetry constraints. So let me also erase maybe here. So let me tell you a little bit about spinors on curved manifolds and what holonomy is. So if you parallel transport a spinor on a curved manifold, the spinor is in general not going to come back to itself. So, but it's going to be coming back. So if you parallel transport a spinor, it's going to come back by a rotation, which I can describe by a matrix psi, by a matrix U. And the way we can, I can illustrate this is that, let me make a picture here. And let's think about parallel transport of a simple vector around a closed curve. So suppose we, let me take another color here, would like to parallel transport a vector along this closed path. So what we well, well, it's not too parallel, but my drawing is not so good, so let me just, so what you, at the end, so if you parallel transport this, what you see is that you end up with an angle. Well, okay, I exaggerated here, so that's not, well, let me put an angle here. So what you end up is that there is an angle. So what you see is that the vector doesn't come back to itself. You make a parallel transport, better than my parallel transport. So and what you see is that the vector is going to go back not to itself, but it's going to be rotated. And the rotation you can in general describe by a matrix U. This is in general going to be an SON matrix from the Lorentz group. And so this matrices form a group that is called the holonomy group of the manifold. So U forms a group, belongs to a group, let me say it that way. Group which is called the holonomy of the manifold. And the most general in the most general case, the holonomy is going to be SON. But for particular types of manifolds, we are going to have a reduced holonomy. And in the case of Calabi-Yau manifolds, the holonomy, so of a Calabi-Yau manifold, the holonomy is SUN. So and the way we can describe more concretely this matrix U is in terms of the spin connection, which is something that we need in the covariant derivative of a spinner. So the spin connection has precisely the same role as the gauge field plays in ordinary electromagnetism. So let me go over here. So you can write, so we can write down this matrix U in terms of the spin connection. So let me call this the spin connection. But let me show you more precisely so what the spin connection is. So as I said, the spin connection emerges as a gauge field. And in order to, similarly as in electromagnetism, which means that it's going to appear in the covariant derivative of a spinner. So covariant derivatives of spinners are going to include, so let me call psi a general spinner. So in general, we are going to have the ordinary derivative of the spinner. But then we are going to have something that is called the spin connection, which is a matrix. So it's an SON matrix in general. And let me put here gamma matrices times psi. So this omega here is called the spin connection. The index, so what you see that it's a matrix. So this M and N, so this indices that I wrote with M and N, the Latin letters here, run over the number of generators of my group. So say you have SU3. So these indices go from 1 to 8. So this one here labels the group elements. While the mu that I wrote down here, it's a space-time index. So that's the one. So if you are in four space-time dimensions, so the mu grows from 0 to 3. So it's a space-time index. By the way, maybe I should have pointed out, so the formalism that, so this is called the Fehlbein formalism. Maybe I should have said that at the beginning. So it's called the Fehlbein formalism. And you need to use this formalism each time you describe spinners on curved manifolds. Yes, there was a question.
What are the gamma?
Ordinary gamma matrices.
But with the two indices, you use mean products again?
It's again the anti-symmetrized product of gamma matrices. Thank you, yeah.
So Dirac gamma matrices or like Christoffel symbols?
No, Dirac matrices.
OK.
No Christoffel symbols. I guess you saw Christoffel symbols in the previous lecture. No, it's just a gamma matrix, so that satisfies the Clifford algebra. So so what we do have is, so it's called the Fehlbein formalism, and the Fehlbein formalism So in the free run formalism, so we have the spin connection. And the metric, so what we do have is the metric in the field run formalism can be expressed in terms of an object that is called the field line, so which you can essentially see as the square root. So in a very rough manner, you can call it the square root of the metric. Here I'm ending. So very roughly, it's the square root of the metric. So in other words, somebody gives you a metric, you in principle are able to compute, well, you are able to compute from there how the field lines of your theory look like. And the reason why I'm telling you about the field lines is that if you do have the field lines of a theory, you can determine the expression for the spin connection in terms of the field lines. So I would like to, so what it means that once I do have a metric, I do have the field lines. Once I do have the field lines, I do have the spin connection. So let me show you how the formula that relates the field line to the spin connection looks like. So the defining equation, so the defining equation for the field line is an equation that says that the covariant derivative of the field line is equal to zero. That is the defining equation because an equation like this does have no analog in ordinary relativity. So no analog in relativity. So which is why we would like to set this equal to zero. Let me write this expression out for you. I'll continue over here. Because from there you will see very nicely how one can get the spin connection in terms of field lines. And I tell you, at the end, I will tell you why what I'm kind of telling you right now is relevant for the analysis that we're going to do later. So let me write out that covariant derivative. So this covariant derivative is defined in the following manner. So now comes a Christoffel symbol. So that one was, maybe I should have used different gamma. So that's probably a good point. Yeah, so let me put here. Let me put here maybe a different type of gamma so we don't confuse them. Let me put here a small gamma, and there a large gamma. So plus, here comes the term with the spin connection. So that is an equation. Do I have the indices right? Yeah, I think so. So that is an equation which connects the spin connection. So it relates the spin connection and the field line. So you know that Christoffel symbols, you know, once you do have the metric, you can compute the Christoffel symbols. So what this equation, so you can solve this equation for the field line in terms of, for the spin connection in terms of the field line. And what you get is an expression that looks in the following way. So let me not write out all the terms, but let me just show you how some of the terms in the equation look like. Plus more terms that follow by changing the indices. So, the other observation that is going to be important is that the Riemann tensor, so the Riemann tensor of the manifold can be expressed in terms of the spin connection. So let me tell you how the formula looks like. Again, so I won't be able to show you how all those formulas look like, but at the end you're going to see what the message of what I'm telling you right now is. So. So this shows that I can, so in principle, I can, by contracting with two E's, with two field binds, I can get the Riemann tensor. Maybe I should write it down. So let me, just for completeness, let me write down how the formula, if I take how the formula for the Riemann tensor looks like, where these flat indices are transformed into curved indices. So we can raise and lower, we can change that by contracting with a field bind. So here's the formula. So this formula is telling us that once we do have the spin connection in our theory, so we can compute how the Riemann tensor in our theory looks like. And the reason why the story that I'm telling you is relevant, because we are going to later on, let me erase here. So when we get to the hadronic string, what we are going to do is to evaluate solutions to the equation nabla mu psi equal to 0. And from nabla mu psi equal to 0, which is an expression which contains the spin connection, I'm going to get information about the geometry of the manifold. So I will be able to make statements about Riemann tensors and so on because there is the spin connection in this covariant derivative. And this determines for me the geometry. OK. So far for what I wanted to say about the spinors on curved manifolds. And let me see what I would like to say next. Oh, regarding the Kähler, so I'm going to define, so which was the question, so what is a Kähler manifold? So let me hold this for a little bit later, because I'm going to explain this a little bit more explicitly. But let me just give you first some simple examples of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So simple examples, so that we can imagine what a Calabi-Yau manifold is. So simple examples of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So take a Calabi-Yau one-fold, which is a two-dimensional, a real two-dimensional extended object manifold. So T2 is a compact example. So T2, which is the product of S1 times S1, the circles that we have been discussing. So it's a compact example. But Calabi-Yau manifolds don't have to be compact. So you can take as a non-compact example the complex plane. So then you can go, so this is Calabi-Yau two-folds. Then you can go to Calabi-Yau one-folds, I mean. So these are one-folds, which are two-dimensional manifolds. Then you can look at how two-folds look like. And there are basically just two, give me just a second. There are basically just two compact two-folds, which are T4 and K3. So these are the only ones, so the only two compact examples of Calabi-Yau two-folds. There was a question before I continue.
Do you mean complex plane is C, not C squared?
Oh, it's C2. I mean the complex plane.
Okay, so it's two complex dimensions, but four-dimensional.
No, you're right. C, good. Thank you. Good point. So, and you, of course, can have non-compact examples like T2 times C. But the funny thing is, from the compact examples of two-folds, there are just two. If you go now to the three-fold case, so there's a very large number of them. So for the Calabi-Yau three-folds, so there's an enormously large number. And people don't even know nowadays whether this number is finite. So Calabi-Yau three-folds, there are probably infinitely one, probably an infinite number. So an example, you can take T6 But T6 has much more symmetries than an ordinary Calabi-Yau manifold. That will be an example that we later on don't want to consider. Yes, there was a question. What is K3? Well, there's an orbifold limit of K3. You can view it as a two torus with some identifications. But K3, I cannot give you a metric. So there's no metric for K3. So neither for Calabi-Yau manifolds nor for K3, you're able to give me a metric to define the manifold. So it's a two-dimensional manifold that is scalar and that is Ricci flat. So, but you can basically, in some limit, you can write K3 as T2, whoops, as T2, T4 mod Z2. So there are some discrete identifications that I don't want to get into, but imagine it in some limit, you can represent it in this way. So as I was saying, so there are an infinite number of three folds, and well, it's not even known whether there's an infinite number. And one example of them is T6, but T6 has much more symmetries than what we would like to have, and it gives you too much supersymmetry in four dimensions, so T6 is not a good example of what we would like to consider. Yeah? Okay. Well, yeah, okay. Well, they are infinitely compact. You mean in this case? Oh, both. So they are, infinitely compact three-folds. And then, of course, non-compact as well. So there are infinitely many. Well, at least that is what people are checking. So they keep finding new Calabi-Yau manifolds every day. So so more properties of Calabi-Yau manifolds. Calabi-Yau manifolds, so if we give us, as I had mentioned, interesting theories in four dimensions, so Calabi-Yau manifolds give interesting theories in D equal to 4. When we compactify the 8 cross the 8 heterotic string on a Calabi-Yau threefold, well, or the SO32 on a Calabi-Yau threefold. So we obtain a theory with n equal to 1 supersymmetry in d equal to 4. When we take the type 2a or type 2b theory on a Calabi-Yau threefold, we get an n equal to 2 in d equal to 4. So, and the reason why, let me not get into this. So we get an n equal to 2 in d equal to 4. So that's the reason why we are interested in taking compactifications of the heterotic tree on a Calabi-Yau manifold. But as I will show you, so it's something that you don't put in by hand. Calabi-Yau manifolds come out of the theory. So you will see what I mean with that. So let me tell you one property of Calabi-Yau manifolds, which is mirror symmetry, which is something more or less you can view it as the higher-dimensional generalization of the T-duality we have been discussing. So what is mirror symmetry? And again, so I'm not going to be able to show you too much details, but let me just throw the words at you. So mirror symmetry, just give me a second. There was a question.
You told us what Calabi-Yau manifolds are, and why, I guess it's, you're trying to show us why they're useful, but we don't know what Kähler manifold is, or
we are going to, well, Kähler manifold is a complex manifold, of which you can define a Kähler form that is closed. So that doesn't help you. So I wanted to go with you through it a little bit more slowly at the end. So I didn't tell you what Kähler is. Imagine it is it's a complex manifold. On that complex manifold, you can define a two form. This two form is a closed. It's closed. So that's the definition of a Kähler manifold. I'm going to walk you through this a little bit more slowly. But I'm talking what Ricci flood is. Ricci flood means that the Ricci tensor vanishes. And that is the definition of a Kähler manifold for us. Does it help? Yeah? OK. Whoops. Why do I have mirror, mirror? I wrote too many mirrors here. So let me erase one of the mirrors. OK. So mirror symmetry. So mirror symmetry is a generalization of T-duality. So recall that what we had been discussing in the past couple of days is that there is T-duality, which relates the type 2A theory on a circle with radius r to the type 2B theory on a circle of radius 1 over r. So this is T-duality. And mirror symmetry, so there is a similar statement for six-dimensional manifolds. So mirror symmetry tells us that the type 2A theory on a manifold M6, so type 2A on a manifold M6 is dual. In other words, that the same type of fields appear, the same type of interactions appear in the low energy theory. So it's dual to the type 2B theory on M6 tilde. M6 tilde is called the mirror of M6. So M6 tilde is called the mirror of M6. So I'm still something, so showing mirror symmetry, so proving mirror symmetry, it's still something that string theorists haven't been able to do. But you see that if you take type 2A on a manifold and you take its mirror, so I don't want to tell you what the precise definition is, because I would have to get into Hodge numbers that characterize the manifold. But they see it experimentally. If you take type 2A on a manifold, you get the same thing if you take type 2B on the corresponding mirror. So, and the mirror manifolds M6 and M6 tilde are in general two completely different manifolds. They can in general have even completely different topology. So after this little review or little highlights on Calabi-Yau manifolds, so let me show you how Calabi-Yau manifolds appear from the hedrodic theory. And I did want to discuss now the hedrodic theory, because the hedrodic theory involves gauge fields. And the gauge fields are going to play a really important role when next week we'll talk about ADS-CFT. So it might be a good idea to introduce you at this point to a gauge field rather, to the gauge fields rather than discussing compactifications of a different theory where you don't have gauge fields. So let me walk you slowly how the low energy effective action of the hedrodic theory looks like. It looks very, very similar to what we have been discussing in the past days, except for the gauge fields. So so let's take a look at the 10D low energy effective action of the hedrodic stream. So as I was mentioning, so the action takes a very similar form to what we have seen before. So it contains, again, the graviton. It contains a graviton, so the same fields we had before, which were the graviton and the dilaton. Graviton and dilaton. Let me write this down first. So it contains the graviton, the dilaton, and the tensor field. So if you look at this and compare this, what we had in the previous days, so it's exactly the same in writing down. And the difference is going to come, well, maybe, the, oh, yeah, factor of 4. But now comes the difference. So now comes the difference. So the, it incorporates a gate field. And let me use a notation that many people use, and explain to you very slowly what the notation means. So it contains a term that involves a non-abelian gauge field, and it has got a new coupling constant, which is the Young-Mills coupling constant. So, and I'm going to define everything I write down now, I'm going to define for you. So that's how the action of the hydraulic string, low energy effective action of the hydraulic string looks like. As I was pointing out, so this is very familiar to what we had before. We need to worry a little bit why I wrote down here an H3 tilde. So H3 is again D of a, well, I'm going to define it in a second. So H3 tilde is again related to D of a 2 form, but there's a little bit more to it. And I have to tell you how we can read this expression here. So this F here is related to a U1 gauge field that I do have in the theory. So let me define what I have there, and so that we can also read what this expression says. So there's some stuff that we need to, that we're going to learn now. Number one, so H3 tilde is defined as D of the 2 form, so it's again a D of B2, like we had in the past days. But then there is another term, which is the one, so it's another term that involves a U1 gauge field. And again, I'm going to write it in a complicated manner, and then explain you how, well, in a not complicated manner, but in a manner that I still need to explain a little bit to you what the notation means. So this omega 3 is called the Trin-Simons form. This Trin-Simons form involves the A1 gauge field, so there's an A1 gauge field, so a non-abelian gauge field. Let me write it down here. So A is a non-abelian gauge field. So if you deal with so E8 cross E8 hydraulic string, so the gauge group is E8 cross E8, so non-abelian gauge field. And this is the corresponding gauge field. So this omega 3 is called the Trin-Simons form. So let me write it first in a sketchy manner, and then I tell you what my sketchy notation, or the conventional notation that I'm using right now, means. So what do I mean with what I wrote down here? So what I mean is number one. So let's try to read what I'm writing down here. I can expand A in terms of generators of the gauge group. So let me expand my gauge field A as in terms of the generators of my gauge group. So you do have SU3, then you take SU3 generators, in this case E8 cross the E8 generators. So these are the generators of the gauge group. And let me put here an AA. So we can expand. So I do have, so again, so this little a runs over the number of generators. So and when I, number one, when I write down a trace here, what I mean is I sum over indices A and A. So let me let me be more precise. Let me put here an M DXM here so that you do have a one form as you wanna have. So let me erase it a moment. So A is the number of generators. So A is this number of generators, and so the A that I wrote down here without any indices at all, I can write down as my generators. So these are going to be matrices in general. I do have a one form, which is this AM. So this M again runs over my spacetime indices. So M are the 10-dimensional spacetime indices. A labels the number of generators that I do have in my theory. I can write down in a similar way. So I'm still not done explaining to you how to read this expression here. So in a similar way, I can write down my f. So I can write down my f as a sum over a, the number of generators, ta times fa. And the fa that I wrote down, so it's now the d of a. But now it contains, so it's the d of the U1 gauge field. But since the gauge group is non-abelian, it contains an additional part. So what is f's are the structure constants. And when I can write down, so let me write down in a similar manner as I did over there. Let me put a little subindex and be more precise. What I mean with the expression that I wrote down here, so that one can see that f is a two form. So let me write it in terms of indices. So the f, so an fmn. A is simply so, and I think probably this is the one you like probably the most. So it's a DM ANA. So again, I do have a different number of gauge field, which is why I do have this little A here, minus DN AMA plus G. So I believe, so this expression we can easily read. So again, so we do have, so these ones are space-time indices, the indices that I do have up here, since I'm dealing with a non-abelian gauge group. So it labels the number of generators of the non-abelian gauge group. And when I write down, so now I erase it, so I wrote down in the action a trace of a square, so the trace of a square that is in the action. So all the trace of a square means is that I'm summing over A, fmn, A, fmn, A. So that's all the trace means. And when I do have my omega 3, so my omega 3 there, maybe I should have, maybe let me erase here and let me, we probably have said this before. So the omega 3, if I write it down in a similar manner as I have done over there, so we can write down omega 3. Maybe this one is easier to read. So omega 3 is equal to, again, so there's a trace here. So I can expand this trace and write this as AA wedge BAA plus 2/3. Young-Mills coupling constant times the structure constants times the wedge product of three A's. So that's something that probably when you discuss next week ADS-CFT, so you're going to see all over the place, the F square. So that's probably the first time that you see now how F square looks like in terms of generators, unless somebody discussed it before. So I thought it's a good point to introduce you to it. So are there any questions on this? Okay, so I don't see any questions. So let me then, so I showed you how the action looks like, and let me then come to the point that to evaluate the supersymmetry transformations. So the action that I wrote down a moment ago of the 10-dimensional heterotic string is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. And so the SUSY transformations that leave the action, the entire action, so you need to take, I wrote down just the bosonic part, but the entire action, if you include the fermions, is invariant under SUSY transformations. And in the SUSY transformations, they look in the following way. Well, this field chi that I write down is the supersymmetric partner of the gauge field, which is called the Gluino. So again, maybe I should write down these gamma matrices in a different manner so that we don't confuse them with Christoffel symbols. So chi is called the Gluino. Then there is a supersymmetry transformation for the gravitino. And so psi here is the gravitino. So this one we had seen before. So psi is the gravitino. And then last, there is the supersymmetric partner for the dilaton, which is called the dilatino. Let me maybe erase there and write it down over here. So last supersymmetry transformation is of the following form, delta lambda is b slash phi times epsilon plus 1 over 24. Where this lambda, as I said, is called the dilatino. So lambda is the dilatino. So this is the form of the supersymmetry transformations that leave the action invariant. And now the question is, can we find a supersymmetric configuration? So what do I mean by that? What I mean with that is I would like to find a configuration that satisfies, so where I can find a spinner. So I do have, well, let me first point out. So what we do have here is epsilons here are 10-dimensional spinners. Epsilon are 10-dimensional spinners. We have a theory that has got an n equal to 1 supersymmetry. So I do have one 10-dimensional spinner. So epsilon is a 10D spinner. And I believe you have got some homework on spinners that you're going to solve in the tutorial. So epsilon is a 10-dimensional spinner, and a supersymmetric configuration is one configuration where you can find a spinner epsilon that satisfies delta epsilon acting on the fermion is equal to 0. So this is the definition of a supersymmetric configuration. So we can find, so there exists an epsilon that satisfies this equation. So if you look at our supersymmetry transformations, so the deltas of the fermions that are wrote down, so what we see is, well, it involves the epsilons, and it involves the F, and it involves the H, and it involves the matrix, so it involves here the spin connection. So what I see is that if I require delta of a fermion equal to 0, so if I set this here equal to 0, and I assume, so let me put this here, equal to 0, equal to 0 and the other one equal to 0. So what I can see is that if I assume that there exists an epsilon so that this equation can be satisfied, what I can see is I can obtain constraints for the fields in my theory. I will be able to derive you a constraint. So what are the Fs that satisfy this condition? What are the ages that satisfy? What are the tensor fields that satisfy this condition? And now comes also the very important point. What are the metrics? So what is the, what geometries satisfy such a condition? So that's the reason why I was talking so much about spin connections, because you will see that when I try to solve this equation here, I will be able to obtain information from the geometry of the manifold, because in this covariant derivative here is the spin connection sitting. Yes? Why is it the supersymmetry transformation of the fermions that is important?
Why do we not worry about the bosons?
Oh, because the bosons are going to go. Okay, that's a, maybe that's a good question, because the bosons are going to be. So I would like. Classical fermions are equal to 0. So and if you take a variation of a boson, so if you write down delta of a boson, so you're going to have naturally on the right hand side fermions. So you're going to have on the right hand side your chi's, your psi m, and your lambda. But the point is that if you look for a classical configuration, these beats are going to be 0. So you are not going to obtain any constraints on your fields. While if I do it in the other way around, delta epsilon of a fermion, I obtain on the right-hand side all the bosonic fields. And the constraint is going to derive for me constraint on the fields and on the geometry. So that was a good question. So let me see whether. How much time do I still have? Because I don't want to kind of.
5 minutes.
5 minutes still? 5 to 10 minutes. OK, so then we're fine. So let me show you how the constraints on the geometry follow by solving the equations for. So by the way, so that's what I meant when we talk about solving equations for the supersymmetry constraints. And what you see is the thing that I was pointing at the out at the beginning. So you see that all these equations are first order in derivatives. So it's a d slash, which is contraction of gamma m with dm. So it's equations that are all first order in derivatives. If I write down the equations of motion of the theory, so Einstein tensor, it involves second derivatives, which are much harder to solve. So here you see the first order equations popping out. So what I would like to do is to show you how the solution of this equation looks like. And now comes another important point that I wanted to tell, which is the way these equations were originally solved. So they were these equations were evaluated in 1985 in a famous paper by Horowitz, Strominger, Candelas, and Witten. So and the way they solved initially these equations, they said, OK, for simplicity, I would like to kick out some of the fields. So they took away this one. They set it to 0. And they took the dilaton, which is this one here. So the dilaton here, they took phi to be a constant. So that was the original Calabi-Yau paper. And it was a restriction they did for simplicity. A year later, Strominger realized that such a restriction you don't have to do. You can take your H field, because why on earth would you set the H flux, the H field equal to 0 by hand? Or why do you take the phi equal to constant? It's not going to give you the most general solution. So what you can see is that if you set this H equal to 0, phi equal to constant, you're going to be deriving Calabi-Yau manifolds as solutions, flux compactifications, which hopefully I will get tomorrow too, are generalizations of Calabi-Yau manifolds where you take this H flux into account and the dilaton is not a constant. So H equal to 0 will give us Calabi-Yau. And when people talk about flux compactifications, what they mean is compactifications where the H flux or corresponding other fluxes in other theories is different from zero. So these are flux compactifications. So let me tell you how the simpler case where we set the H field equal to zero, dilaton equal to constant, can be worked out. So what I see, I see the point of the argument they had. So I see that if I set the dilaton equal to constant, this term is gone. I see if I set the H equal to zero, this term is gone. So this equation is naturally satisfied. If I look, so let me erase this one, the dilaton equation, which imposes no constraints in our theory on our fields. And let me kick out this H flux here. What I see is I obtain two equations that I need to evaluate. So I'm not too concerned about this first one, which is going to give us an equation that is called Donaldson-Lundbeck-Yau equation, but it's an equation for the gauge field. But the one I would like to show you is how the equation dm epsilon equal to zero constrains our internal geometry. So let me again point out this big M here. So we are still talking about 10-dimensional quantities because the big M that I wrote down here runs over all 10-dimensional indices. So these are 10D indices. And my epsilon here is a 10-dimensional spinner. So let me put the epsilon, so just so that we see in a moment the difference, let me call the epsilon epsilon 10 just to indicate that it's a 10-dimensional spinner. And if I would like to now evaluate how the constraints appear in the lower dimensional theory, what I do have to do is to decompose the field. So the 10-dimensional metric, I have to decompose it in terms of the 4-dimensional and the 6-dimensional metric in a very similar manner. So as we did for the Kalitzer-Klein ansatz when we compactified on a circle. So we can make a similar ansatz here for the metric. So here comes the generalization of the KK ansatz. So what I would like to assume is that my 6-dimensional, my 10-dimensional manifold is the product of a 6-dimensional manifold, which is going to depend on coordinates, let me call them y, times a 4-dimensional manifold or external spacetime that I would like to call x. So coordinates of the, so this is external spacetime. So what I can do is I can take my 10-dimensional metric and decompose it in the way we wrote it with the circle. So I would like to decompose it in the following way into a 4-dimensional metric. So let me call this g mu nu of x and a 6-dimensional internal metric. So let me call this g6. And let me label those indices mn of y, while I would like to take the off-diagonal components equal to 0, again, for simplicity. So those spaces are called maximally symmetric spaces. So I'm setting, so by hand, I'm setting the gauge field equal to 0. So the metric is going to decompose into two chunks like this. So this describes the external spacetime. This describes the internal geometry. So another thing, so before I go and look how to evaluate these equations, I need to decompose my spinner as well. So my 10-dimensional spinner, I have to write down in terms of lower dimensional quantities. And again, I think you have put some exercise on spinners for the tutorial of today. So my 10-dimensional spinner, I have to decompose into 4-dimensional spinners, so let me call them epsilon 4 times epsilon 6. So these are 60 spinners. And these are 40 spinners. So in principle, there's a complex conjugate because of property of spinors, but let me kind of just be a little bit sketchy and write it down in this manner. So what I can do is let me then, and I'm almost done here. So what I can do is I can then write my 10-dimensional equation. So lambda m acting on my 10-dimensional spinner. So let me put epsilon 10. So it's going to have so this m here. So let me introduce m. So this is an equation that goes for where this index runs either over the 4-dimensional indices, which I'm going to call mu, or the 6-dimensional indices, which I'm going to call m. So this equation then decomposes into two equations, one that tells me that nabla mu acting on the 4-dimensional spinner, epsilon 4 is 0, and the second equation, nabla m acting on my 6-dimensional spinner is equal to 0. And now we have to evaluate those conditions. So let me should I mention this or not? Okay, let me, maybe I'll write down one step of the calculation. So again, so I had motivated how the spin connection gives us information about the geometry, and then you can at least get a sense of why there's an equation. So not sure whether you would like to check this as a homework exercise. So if you have an equation that tells you nabla mu epsilon 4 equal to 0, you can derive by taking the commutator of two such derivatives. An equation that involves the Riemann tensor. So and that's the reason why I was emphasizing so much about spin connections, the connection between spin connections and Riemann tensors. So you have to do, of course, the detailed calculation, but at least you can imagine why from an equation containing the covariant derivative, there could appear geometric information on the right-hand side. So you can derive an equation which looks in this manner. So what it means is that if you do have the constraint nabla mu epsilon 4 equal to 0, you have that this expression is equal to 0. And if you assume maximal symmetry, then it means that your 4-dimensional spacetime is Minkowski, so flat Minkowski. So if you add to this maximal symmetric spaces, which I didn't define in detail, I could do that, but let me not do that. So what we have is that the external spacetime comes out to be Minkowski. So, and again, it's something that I didn't put in. It's something that came out of the calculation. So in principle, I took a general metric on the 4-dimensional space, and my calculation says, okay, if you would like to have a supersymmetric configuration, then your external spacetime has to be Minkowski spacetime. We can do a similar, so applying this formula again, but now for the 6-dimensional spinner. So let me just erase here the indices. Or let me just copy it one more time. So a similar equation for my 6, so let me put the mean back here, for my 6-dimensional spinner. It's going to contain, again, so the information about the geometry, so it's the same formula. And while in the first case, I was assuming that I do have a maximally symmetric space, which means I'm assuming that the Riemann tensor has a very specific form in terms of the metric that I didn't write down, so which gave me that the four-dimensional external space is Minkowski. In this case, I cannot go and conclude that the internal manifold is six-dimensional flat space. But what I can do is to show that this equation is equivalent to the statement that the manifold, the internal manifold, is Ricci flat. So here comes the first ingredient of Calabi-Yau manifold. So the internal geometry is Ricci flat. Which again, so it's a totally cruel statement because you assume a general metric. You say, okay, so tell me what the solutions to the supersymmetry equations are, and your equations tell you, okay, well, take a manifold that is Ricci flat. Otherwise, you don't get a supersymmetric configuration. And so now comes my last point, which is the definition of the Kähler manifold. So once we do have the spinners, so let's go for the last point. So we know that M6 has to be Ricci flat. So let's see what it means for M6 to be Kähler. And again, I'm not going to show all the details. So what is a Kähler manifold? So a Kähler manifold and I'll argue in a moment why M6 is a Kähler manifold. So a Kähler manifold is a complex manifold and there's a formal definition. So there's a formal definition of what a complex manifold is that I don't want to get into. So you can also define what a complex manifold is. For the moment, just take it. It's a manifold on which you can define complex coordinates. So it's a complex manifold that is Hermitian. So for a manifold to be Hermitian, so what this means is Hermitian means that you can define that the metric components, so you are going to have complex coordinates, and the metric, the only non-vanishing components of the metric are the ones that connect A's and bars. So say, imagine this as Z and Z bar, while the components of the metric that are of the form, say, ZZ, are equal to zero. Same thing for the bars. So if you have a complex manifold that has got a metric that looks in this way, then it's called an Hermitian manifold. Okay, well, I just was putting general indices, so I can put B bars. Doesn't matter. Oh, you mean, okay. I see what you're saying. So you're saying, well, yeah, you could put A bar as well, yeah. So no, the only entries that don't vanish for the manifold are the ones that connect indices that are bars and not bars. Oh, why did I say that? Okay, so that's the problem. Okay, I see your problem. Okay, that's different from zero. Thank you. So, okay, while the other components, B bar, are equal to zero. Okay. So that's what an Hermitian manifold is called. And once you do have an Hermitian manifold, then you can get a Kähler manifold if on that manifold you can find a two form. So Kähler means you can define a two form, J, A, B bar, which is related to the metric. So let me put it in this way. And the Kähler form is closed. So J is closed. So let me put a DJ. So this DJ is closed. J is closed. So it's closed. So and once you can find a two form, so it's basically, so this two form is related to the metric. And once you can show that this two form is closed, then the manifold is called Kähler. And J is called the Kähler form. so that we are completely happy about what a Keller manifold is. Let me just show you an example of one Keller manifold, and then I will argue why the internal geometry is a Keller manifold. So an example of a Keller manifold is S2. So S2 is Keller. So and for S2, you can write down your line element as dz times dz bar divided by 1 plus z bar squared. So that's a particular example of a Keller manifold. You can get the J, so the Keller form. So Keller form for this manifold is then simply I over 2 dz, which dz bar divided by 1 plus z bar square. So that's an example of a Keller manifold, which you, of course, can see that it's Keller. This dj, you can see from here, dj is equal to 0. That's an example of a Keller manifold. And so that's this. Oh, it still didn't answer. The J is defined in such a way that J is of this form. So there's no J that doesn't have off-diagonal components. So if it exists, it's related to the off-diagonal components of the metric. But there is no J of AA or B bar. So it's defined in this way here. And if you can show that this thing here is closed, then it's a Keller form. Yes?
The metric is a two-form, and what you've written up there seems to suggest that J is a two-form, which is just the metric multiplied. I'm sorry, it's not a two-form because it's a metric, but it's like a two, it's a two thing. Anyway, what you've written seems to suggest that J is just I times G, but...
You're right that this thing is a two-form. Okay, but the coefficients are, you can identify this with the metric coefficients. So you can write down, so let me maybe say it this way. So you can write down your J, let's see if you can see it this way, J A B bar D Z A, which D Z bar B bar, or if you so would like to use what I was saying a moment ago, so put like I J A B bar.
Okay.
Is that what you meant?
Sort of. So, like, just thinking of G and J as, like, abstract, I don't want to say two things that take in two vectors and spit out a number.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true that J is just equal to I times G.
Okay.
Is that
accurate? Yeah, let me put it in. So what I meant with this is...
Is it possible to define J in terms of G just as things that take in two vectors and spit out a number?
J in terms
like
of
without
G.
Talking about components.
Yes, we'll do that later.
Okay.
So if you're gonna do that later, okay. So then let me postpone this for later, and let me just last remark I would like to make. So you can explicitly construct, explicitly show that. You can define such a two-form on the internal manifold. So you can explicitly, or let me just put it in this way. So you can from the equations, we had an equation that was telling us that nabla M acting on epsilon 6 is equal to 0. And you can from this, so this equation I should have probably said is called the Killing-Spinner equation. And the spinner epsilon 6 is called covariantly constant. And using, in terms of this covariantly constant spinner, you can construct the two form, which is the carrier form of your manifold. So J, I'm just going to throw it at you and not go into more details. So you can find the J. So let me put this J M N as epsilon. Let me put an epsilon 6. I should have introduced the chirality, but I mean it. J M N epsilon 6. Let me be a little bit more precise. So I can, this epsilon 6, I can, in principle, write down with plus and minus. So there are two spinors with plus and minus chirality. So let me put here a plus. And let me put a dagger here. Plus, so you can show, which I didn't tell you in detail, that if you do have a form like this, you can show that J is a complex structure. A Keller form. Shouldn't have said complex structure. It's the Keller form of a manifold. So you need to work. I didn't tell you all that is involved. So you first need to show, having this, that the manifold is a complex manifold, which I didn't tell you how a complex manifold is defined. Once you know that it's a complex manifold, you have to show that it's Hermitian. Once you know that it's Hermitian, you have to show that the Keller form is closed. So I haven't showed you all the details, so I just went quickly over it. But this is how, if you now look at it one more time, a little bit more slowly on your own, you will see how Calabi-Yau manifolds appear as solutions to the supersymmetry constraints. So, and I think that's what I wanted to tell you today. So I'll stop here. And as I say, I don't expect you to follow all the details of the story that I told you. But if you now start going through the book one more time, you read it slowly, I think you will be able to understand some connections. So that's it for today.